5 of season 12 of Move Our Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we where we dig our way through the 1994 film The Shawshank Redemption, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today to finish off the week is Jay Cluett of Deep Blue Sea, the podcast. Welcome back once again, Jay, to finish off the first week of yet another movie.
Thank you. I'm going to be a decidedly inconvenient guest today, I think. Not sure how, but we'll see. See how it goes.
Because you don't have very much to say. Is that what you're hinting at?
I have the most to say about this one, I think. But that line of decidedly inconvenient is just one of the deliveries from this film that's just always stuck with me. That's one of my favorite lines from the film. Just like, you're on the stand, you're trying to defend yourself, and this is the way you're going to come off in court. It's just, you're just trying to get sent to prison for back-to-back life sentences, I think, is the intention.
Yeah, well, you know, the plot wouldn't work so well if he was set free. So I guess you sort of got to give him some credit for that. What can you do? It would be a very bad prison movie if the guy actually doesn't go to prison.
You got to think, how many prison movies are we missing out on from all the people that don't get sent to prison?
But those are films a little more compelling, you know, in the courtroom scenes, and they don't just have 5 or 6 minutes of courtroom scenes. You know, they go a little
way more minutes of courtroom scene than I was expecting. When you said doing Shawshank, I was like, okay, the first 5 minutes, I'll probably get up to Andy arriving at prison. I'll probably like him getting off the bus will probably be like where that first week's going to end.
No, not even close.
That's
going to be like week 3.
I know.
You know. That's why when you do these things minute by minute, you get a whole new perspective on whatever movie it is that you're doing. Because you look at it and you're like, oh my God, I didn't realize that it takes either this short amount of time to get to a particular place or this long amount of time. You know, I was recently talking with a friend of mine who just started listening to my Plane, Trains, and Automobiles season on it. And, you know, he's been, you know, raving about it every day. And he's like, yeah, I'm in the third week or fourth week. And, you know, they're already at the hotel. And I'm like, what? And like, and I had to think back and I was like, okay, yeah, it doesn't take them that long to get to the hotel. You know, they're within 20 minutes of the movie. They're already in the hotel.
I listened at the adverse is I listened to the Too Fast, Too Forever podcast talking about the Fast and Furious franchise. They talk about the films, they one film every month and another a film similar to it every month, and then every other week they do 1 minute of the film, and they're on Tokyo Drift at the moment, but they've worked out, so they do 1 minute every 2 weeks.
Basically.
And they've worked out when they get to I think it's Furious 6 that has the really long airport runway sequence. That sequence is going to take them 6 months to talk about.
Wow. It's a 25 minute sequence,
but that's many years away from getting that. So yeah,
well, it goes back again to why I didn't do Band of Brothers 1 minute at a time.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah,
you need to think about what you're doing. But what? There's nobody who's doing who did any of the Fast and Furious movies minute by minute.
Someone did it a quarter film at a time, because it's the famous line, "Live life a quarter mile at a time." I think they should have done it a quarter hour at a time. Personally, I think you should do it in 15-minute chunks. Would be fine. Would have been a quarter film is some of these films are an hour and a half. Some of these films are nearly 3 hours. So a quarter film is flexible, but I think a quarter hour would have worked. But
in other words,
I'm sure there are other people out there.
4 episodes for each of the movies.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
To each his own. Again, that's one of the great things about the idea of the podcast. You know, that everyone chooses their own format and decides how they want to do it and how they want to split things up.
Absolutely. Like that. Yeah. We go scene by scene on Deep Blue Sea, and so we would. All of this courtroom stuff would have been done in one scene, probably.
How did it work? Well, in Deep Blue Sea, do things jump back and forth between different people? Different, like, people in different places?
Uh, Rarely. We broke it up into DVD chapters, is how we actually did
But
it
no, that I
for
know.
DBC. For
That's
Con Air, we went more scenes. But yeah, so there's not a lot of jump. The most you'd have is when Preacher's in the kitchen and the others are looking at the damaged sub room. There's like a little bit. Yeah, I think there's like three cuts between scenes in one. In one, three cuts between locations in one chapter. I think is about the most that you have. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. And how many times have you do you have any idea how many times you've seen Deep Blue Sea?
No, not at all. Not enough, I would say. I intend to keep watching it forever. I've logged it on Letterboxd maybe 10 times, but I watched it a lot growing up. Mark has seen it even more because Mark worked in the cinema when it was playing, and he would just go in and watch it. And he'd love to go in the bit where Sam Jackson gets killed, and just watch the reactions to that bit, which I can understand.
Right, I completely understand that too, but it's no longer a surprise. See, that's the thing.
Sure, it was never a surprise to me either, because the first time, before I had seen the film, my neighbor Simon Pothelswaite said, "Hey, come around and check out this scene from this film," and he fast forwarded his VHS of Deep Blue Sea to like watch this bit to Sam Jackson getting killed. I was like, "Oh, that was a cool scene." And then like the following year, I bought the DVD off my sister for £1 because she'd got it free with her DVD player, and she didn't want it. And she couldn't give it to me. She couldn't give me a DVD. I
What
had
do
to
you think?
buy
Is
it
your
off
sister
them.
at fault for this whole for the whole podcast?
No, not at all. She gets no credit for anything. I would have seen it and loved it at some point. I've bought other DVDs from her that I don't record podcasts on.
No, specifically
Yeah,
talking
I'm
about this
trying to think what
one.
else.
She's responsible for getting you hooked on Deep Blue Sea.
I'm saying no, not at all. I think she is responsible for me owning the first DVD that I have of it, but I
Okay.
would have seen it and loved it regardless of that. I'm saying there are other films that I bought of her and watched that I don't do a podcast
Right,
on because they're not Deep Blue Sea.
I understood that. I understood. Interesting.
Yeah,
Okay.
anyway.
All right, so minute five begins with the DA finishing his question and ends with the DA giving his summary. We ended things yesterday with the DA basically saying, "Now, does that strike you as a fantastic coincidence, Mr. Dufresne, or is it just me?" And Andy then in a low voice basically says, "Yes, it does." He goes, "Yet you still maintain that you threw your gun into the river before the murders took place. That's very convenient." Then Andy goes, "It's the truth." And we get the costume design credit for Elizabeth McBride. In the prison itself, I don't know, that they do need a lot of work on the specific costumes, but they're not varied. It's pretty much the
Well, there
same.
is some variety. There's variety in styling, especially when you get like Tommy coming in. He's got his collar all the way up and his sleeves rolled up.
Well,
But
in the
it's
60s,
still the same costume, but the styling is different. I don't know whose remit that would fall under in terms of the credits. But I believe it'd probably still be under costume design.
right? Okay, that's. I mean, she only has
Yeah, and it,
20 credits on IMDb as a costume designer, and it actually ends in 1996 because she passed away in 1997. There's a good reason for
Sure. Okay.
that. She unfortunately passed away at the age of 42 in 1997. She had cancer. So besides doing Shawshank, she did Driving Miss Daisy, Thelma and Louise, and Tender Mercies, and she won an Oscar for her work on Driving Miss Daisy in the costume design.
Yeah, so a lot of prison uniforms and suits in this film. So not there's not a lot of scope for winning an Oscar for this one, I think. But it all fits. I do like Jeffrey DeMunn's suit in this scene. It's I wouldn't wear it, but it's I don't know. It's a lot of suit. It's you don't see it that much in this chapter. Actually, would have been more yesterday or Wednesday, but it's the full like double-breasted kind of thing.
Well, you can see Andy's also. Andy's got his
Yeah,
red
sure.
tie. I don't know if someone is accused of murder, it's a good idea to have a red tie.
This is the thing with Andy. I think he's just dressed for work. He's like just wearing the same kind of suit, shirt and tie he would just wear to the bank, and he's just going to court. And then he's not acting any differently than he would in real life outside of the courtroom because he's innocent. He didn't do it. He's just going to go, state the facts, and life will go on. He's sad that his wife has been killed. He's not the one who killed her. He's going to try and move on as best he can.
Yeah.
Except if he gets incarcerated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
I imagine if, like, this could be in the morning, if he's, like, he's thinking, okay, I'll be let off, and then I'll go into work in the afternoon.
Right.
I'll be at the bank after lunch. Yeah.
Okay. That works.
I'm ready dressed for it, yeah.
That's right. They're expecting me at the bank to go fill out tax forms for people.
I've got a meeting at 2:30.
Exactly. And then the DA continues, and first of all, they give us a great panning shot of people in the courtroom. You know, it doesn't look like it's a jury trial, because we don't at this point see a jury.
Sure.
I'm trying to remember if next week we will actually be told that it's, you know, the Madam Foreperson or Mr. Foreman.
I don't think so. I think we just see the judge.
I think it's just the judge, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, the people in the courtroom, first of all, it's a packed courtroom, a small courtroom, but it's still packed. And everyone's just staring at him. They're staring at,
yeah,
at this man who apparently, you know, killed his wife. And then we get, sure, as it's panning, we get the credit for the production designer, Terrence Marsh, who passed away in 2018 at the age of 86. He has quite a lot of credits also. He has 35 credits as production designer, including The Hunt for October. I know you love that movie. Mm-hmm. He was the art director on Dr. Zhivago. He was the art director on Oliver. What's great here is he actually has two cameos in Mel Brooks movies. Okay, in To Be or Not to Be, he plays a startled British officer. My assumption is it's at the end, you know, when, have you seen To Be or Not to Be?
I have not. Mel Brooks, not one of my directors, okay. I'll be honest. He's not a guy I've seen all of his stuff.
Okay, but regardless, at the very end, there's a scene where Mel Brooks is dressed up as Hitler and shows up in a pub in England, and everyone's in shock because he goes, is this England?
Oh.
And they all think that it's the actual Hitler. So I'm assuming that he's in that scene. And then he's also in Spaceballs. He plays the drum beater. There's a certain scene where they have a Spaceball band or orchestra.
Okay. I have seen Spaceballs.
Yes. So, if you look on IMDb, you can see a picture, actually, of him playing the drums, you know, with the Spaceball helmet. So it's pretty funny. He was nominated 4 times in his career for an Oscar for art direction, set direction. First time, and he won 2 out of 4 of those times. He won for Dr. Zhivago. He won for Oliver. And then he lost for Scrooge and Mary, Queen of Scots in 70 and 71. Comes to that. He was nominated for a BAFTA 3 times for Scrooge, A Bridge Too Far, and The Hunt for October, and unfortunately didn't win any of them. He received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Art Directors Guild in 2010. He also did the art direction for The Green Mile. So I guess, you know, Frank Darabont liked what he did here. And he's like, hey, you're good at dressing up a prison. Let's do another prison movie. And this time it's going to be in different colors. Instead of gray, we're going to use green this time. So, yeah. So Andy is protesting and basically says, you know, it's the truth. And then the DA goes, the police dragged the river for 3 days and nary a gun was found. I love the way he says that, nary a gun.
Yeah.
I it's not really something that people use in normal conversations. You know, I can't recall anyone ever using that phrase in a conversation. Can you?
Not nary a gun, but I do use the word nary sometimes. I'm prone to
because of Shawshank.
I don't know. It's okay, you know,
people,
maybe
you
that could be where it first
and say, isn't that convenient? They drag the river.
Yeah, decidedly convenient.
And Mary, a screw was found.
Yep. Where I start to get hazy is I couldn't find the right screw.
Exactly. And then he goes, so there could be no comparison made between your gun and the bullets taken from the bloodstained corpses of your victims, which again, I think is another time to scream objection, because that's...
Well, no, yes, I think it's interesting. I think the prosecutor is screwing up a little bit there, because he's allowing there to be a difference between the gun that Andy had and the bullets that were fired.
That's true.
Like, he is proposing that this is a difference. So if there were a jury and I was in it, I'd be like, well, hang on a minute, you're saying that this isn't the same gun. I know it's allowing that there isn't allowing for a comparison, but I just think they could have been worded differently to sound more guilty.
Yeah, it
doesn't need to be. Andy's not getting out of this, but that's just there's room for I don't know what the term would be. I'm no lawyer. I've not been in a court case. I've just seen films.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine too. So he's basically referring here to the idea of ballistics. You know, they weren't able to compare the bullet to the gun. Do you know anything about the history of ballistics? Like, how far back does it go?
No.
They were able to do these type of things.
I'm going to say it goes back to slightly after guns were invented.
Well, it definitely goes back very far, but it goes back to 1835 when someone was able to match a bullet to a specific mold by identifying unique manufacturing defects in the gun. So they're able to point that out. And then, a lot of times you'll see in movies where they show, two bullets through a microscope, and you can see both sides at the same time. You know, so you can look at the scratches, the indentation and stuff. So the comparison microscope was created in or was invented in 1923, where you would be able to place the pictures of two bullets side by side in order to compare the unique look and or fingerprints of the scratches left by the gun's rifling, and then.
Got to be in a film somewhere, like that being created, and people just shooting each other willy nilly, and then someone being like, "Aha, we've determined that this bullet came from this gun," and people are like, "What do you mean? Hang on, no, you can't do that. You can't." Now you know who I shot. Who shot? Oh God, no, that's got to be in a film somewhere.
That's right. In 1925, a man named Calvin Goddard, who's known as the father of forensics ballistics, started using this whole idea, and he created the Bureau of Forensic Ballistics in New York, where they would start to compare ballistics. And just 7 years later, in 1932, the FBI crime lab started using that also, and in order to try to make things a little more identifiable, which it's really cool because, like, when you're watching a movie like this and they make a comment in 1947 about that they can do ballistics, my first thought is that they can do ballistics in 1947, and apparently it happened more than 100 years later, so goes back very, very far from that perspective. But again, my problem with the DA's comments here is the fact that he's referring to the bodies as bloodstained corpses. I think he's going a little overboard with being as descriptive as he wants to be.
I think he's ramping up to what we see next week.
Yes.
That I don't get to be a part of, but one more bullet per lover.
That's right. And that also
he's ramping up to that.
And that also is very convenient, isn't it, Mr. Dufresne? So basically what he's saying is there, isn't it convenient that we weren't able to compare the bullet to what you did? So he's basically including non-evidence.
Yeah, like this all ties on they couldn't find Andy's gun.
It all hangs on that.
Yeah.
No, I think their idea is that they're saying if he's li- he we dragged the river and couldn't find the gun, so he must be lying about that. So if he's lying about that, he's lying about the murder. Yeah. You know, which is also a pretty big jump. I think that in a real court of law, you need more proof, because I don't think they have very much proof here.
We couldn't find the gun, so your name's not even Andy Dufresne.
That's right. We couldn't find the gun, and it was your wife who was killed, so it must be you.
Yeah. Ipso facto. Yeah.
That's right. And then Andy responds again in a very cold fashion, which once again shows how great an actor Tim Robbins is. And he goes, "Since I'm innocent of this crime, sir, I find it suddenly inconvenient that the gun was never found." And then the shot changes and we see Andy holding the gun, which is a great cut for him to say that I didn't kill her. And then we get a shot of him holding the gun. We get to sort of see what it is that he's going to be doing here.
And I do like that we don't see him not kill her.
Right.
Like we see everything leading up to it, and then we cut away. And it's not until the Elmo Blatch revelation that we actually see more of this scene.
Right.
So you get to talk about it again.
That's right. Now, we get a brief shot this time of actually the label on the whiskey that he's drinking. Did you happen to notice what it is?
Rosewood.
That's right, Rosewood. Yeah. Is he from Beverly Hills Cop?
Could be. It's just a banana in his tailpipe.
Yeah. So Rosewood whiskey is a real form of whiskey. It's not like a Quentin Tarantino made up brand.
Sure.
You know, for the movie itself. And basically it was a type of bourbons and rye whiskeys that were made in the area of Kentucky during that time. And so apparently this is the type of thing that Andy likes. It's a 100 proof.
Well, the thing he could find. Yeah.
Right. Correct. And he's not even.
No, he says when he's in prison, he says he's given up drinking.
I wonder why.
I assume this is yes. Yeah. For all we know, this is his first dalliance with it, and it's not going well.
Well, that, I mean, a slight spoiler from the book. The book actually says that he did drink in prison.
Okay.
He would drink, I think, 3 times a year. I'm trying to remember. It was Christmas. He would have one drink and then give the bottle to whoever else wants. His birthday, and I don't remember the third day. Maybe it was his. I doubt it was his wife's birthday. That wouldn't really make much sense.
Or like his wedding anniversary, that kind of thing. Probably not that either.
He had 4 drinks a year. He would do it a week before his birthday, and then 2 weeks before Christmas. He'd arrange for a bottle of Jack Daniels. On his birthday was the 20th of September. He would have one drink in the morning and one drink at night. And then he would give the rest of the bottle to share around. And then he would have one drink on Christmas Eve and another on New Year's Eve. And the same thing, he would give the bottle back at that point. So again, he would have four drinks throughout the year. I think it works better the way that they show it in the movie, that he says he's given up drinking, because it's just a little strange to have. You know, for them to say, yeah, he gave up drinking, but he's still drinking on his birthday and Christmas and New Year's.
Which we don't need to do that. I mean, he could still have, I say drinking those 4 drinks a year could still be having given up drinking. He's given up drinking regularly and still has them on special occasions. I think that still falls under giving up drinking.
Right, but I think...
I don't think he's an alcoholic.
I think the point of having him in the movie talk about the fact that he's given up drinking is more to the idea that he realizes that he needs to always be in control of himself. And he was not in control when he was drinking, and he realizes that. Yeah. You know, I think that's the way that he looks at that. And then we get another credit on screen for editor, edited by Richard Francis Bruce, who edited 53 different movies. Up until recently, even. He did both 50 Shades Darker and 50 Shades Freed. Those are some of his most recent movies that he's done. He edited Air Force One, Seven, The Rock. You know, because all those movies really compare well with the same tone of Shawshank.
Sure.
Action thriller.
Well, he did The Green Mile.
Right.
He did The Rock, so he likes editing prison films.
Apparently. He even did the first Harry Potter movie. Which depending on where you
Divergent
are,
as well.
That's right. Depending on where you are in the world, it's either Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone or the Philosopher's Stone. Yeah, he did
The Perfect Storm, Ghost Rider.
Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
Sure. Yeah, he did a bunch of George Miller films. He did Lorenzo's Oil, he did Witches of Eastwick.
Yeah. And then, you know, as Andy's in the car, we hear once again the music from the Ink Spots singing, you know, If I Don't Care. And he takes another swig along the way. And then he actually turns the light off in the car. You'd think he would have done this a long time ago.
Well, he's getting out of the car.
No,
so I think he's done. He has loaded the gun. He needed the light on to load the gun, load the bullets in the gun.
No,
he has done that.
But the idea of maybe, you know, you don't want anyone seeing you there.
Then he can't see the gun to put the bullets in.
True. Okay. And as the minute fades out, we start hearing the DA say, "Ladies and gentlemen, and children of all ages." just ladies and gentlemen, obviously. And everyone's going to come back on Monday to find out what he is calling to the attention of ladies and gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jay, do you have anything else you want to talk about this minute or about the movie Shawshank Redemption in general?
Not this minute, but I said earlier I love the line, "It chills my blood just to look at you," which is next week. But other things, if I had been given my choice of minutes, which I don't mind not being given, but if I had been, I probably would have picked Tarring the Roof as a scene that I particularly enjoy and one I think about a lot. I recently moved to a location where there's lots of nice views everywhere. It's quite high up, got a hilly area. And I was doing the roof of my shed last year, and I was just like sat on top of the roof, hammering nails in. And every so often, I just kind of like lean back and look at the view and kind of think about tarring the roof in the Shawshank Redemption. I think it was May actually when we did it as well.
Oh, wow, indeed.
Although watching it this time, I hadn't clocked that they're giving the beers at 10 a.m. On the last day, on the second to last day of their work. And I was like, I feel this should have been an end of the day kind of thing. The end of the second day, you give them the beers, perhaps.
Yeah, you think they would have waited.
So I like that scene.
Because otherwise, these guys, you know, if they waited to the end, then they'd go back to their cells slightly inebriated.
Sure, but giving it to them at the start of the day, you're going to get some sloppy tarring, right. I think. But there we are.
It's true.
So that's that. If it wasn't that scene, then it would have been the discovery of the tunnel scene, and the actual escape sequence is very much my jam. The shot of from inside the tunnel perspective Bob Gunt and Clancy Brown and Morgan Freeman looking in the tunnel.
Yeah.
I tried to paint that scene once. I am not a painter, but I had desires that maybe I could be an artist. And this was when I was like 18, 19. I drew and painted that. And I've not painted people since. That was really, I didn't go well.
Do you still have it?
That was the one. I can do this. It was, I can't find it. I don't know where it is. I had to look for it. I can't find it. I think I've moved house like 3 or 4 times since then. I don't think it survived the move. So that would have been, I love Prison Escape stuff. We'll get to that soon. But I love that sequence. And my favorite line of dialogue in the entire film, "What is your malfunction, you fat barrel of monkey spunk?" is just a lovely line. I don't know how much of that you're going to have to believe, if any, but I really enjoy it as a line.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's my source for the rest of the film.
Yeah, Clancy Brown's character gets some really good lines.
Yeah, Ali Ermi could have played that role, I think. That would have worked
Yeah, you
fine
know
as
what? I
well.
think you're right. Right, very cool. All right, so today's segment is called a Weekend Break, where my guests will tell us their top
Yes.
five movie prison breaks. So,
So I've done two lists. I wasn't sure if you wanted the actual breaks or prison break movies. I wasn't sure, and I didn't think to reread
what
the
do you mean
email,
the
so I've
actual
done
break?
both.
Meaning, is it something about a break itself or the planning of a break? Like
Oh,
what?
it's a film. It's a film that's not like a prison break film, but it has a prison break in it. And it's my actual like it's my favorite prison break sequence in a film that's not a prison break film.
Okay. No, I meant the prison break film.
Okay, well I'll do the other list first then. I'll do the my favorite prison breaks in non-prison break films, just to get that out of the way. Number five, Raising Arizona, not one of my favorite Coen Brothers films. But I do like the prison break sequence of John Goodman and William Forsythe just erupting from this mud, screaming. And I always kind of wonder, like, these two are fools. How have they managed to get out, break out of prison? What hell have they wrought inside that prison to get out? These two large men erupting from the dirt this way. I kind of want to see that sequence, but there we are. So that's number five. Idiocracy has a fun prison break sequence that is just Luke Wilson being like, I'm not supposed to be here, and just walking out because everyone's stupid, and I enjoy that. Number three, The Grand Budapest Hotel, maybe my favorite Wes Anderson film, it's either that or Fantastic Mr. Fox, has a really nice prison break sequence. It's, you know, Wes Anderson's got his wonderful style, so it's just doing a prison break through that lens is fun. Paddington 2, similarly, a delightful scene.
Surprisingly,
A delightful sequence,
you put
him
Paddington
breaking
on
out.
this list.
Yeah, I love Paddington, sure. And my number one is Kung Fu Panda. The Escape of Tai Lung, the Snow Leopard, voiced by Ian McShane. That sequence is pure art. The Kung Fu Panda films are not as respected as they should be. The first one in particular is a beautiful film. It is such a beautiful, stunning film. And that escape sequence of Tai Lung breaking out of this utterly impenetrable, heavily guarded, so many rhinos are guarding this snow leopard, and he breaks out with just a feather, and it's a, I'd love it. Balletic. It's so much. Anyway, great
So,
sequence. So that's
and
number one. That's
okay, a movie that I would add to your list of movies that you just mentioned that are non-prison break movies that have prison breaks is a movie I know you don't like very much. If you could probably even go to say that you detest, but the prison break at the beginning of The Goonies is just great. Okay.
I don't detest The Goonies. The Goonies I put up there with Stand By Me as a film that I just watched too late.
Okay.
I just it's they're films that if you see them as kids when you're the similar age as the kids in them, then I can absolutely understand gelling with them. But I watched that and I watched Stand By Me and I kind of this it's I'm too late for them. They've missed me. I didn't get them,
Okay.
and I don't even recall the prison
Okay.
break
The prison
sequence
break
in The
sequence, you
Goonies.
have Robert
So
Davi in prison with the guards in like a local
Gary
jail, and
Pants.
the guard comes over and sees that he apparently committed suicide. Right? And he walks over and he sees a note on the guy's jacket and he starts reading it and he goes, "You schmuck, do you really think I would kill myself this way?" And then he knocks him out. And then his brother, played by Joey Pants, and his mother, played by Gordon
Ramsay.
Ramsay, come in
And
and help them help him to escape by starting a fire in front of the police station. But whatever. It's just a fun prison
yeah.
break scene.
Everything I remember enjoying about the Goonies is Robert Davi, Joey Pants, and Anna Ramsey.
Okay.
Is the adults, the Fratellis. I don't care for the kids in that film, but the adults are fun.
Well, if you ever get a chance,
So
and
that's my top
if you have the
five.
inclination, you should watch the video commentary they have of the Goonies with all the kids when they're grown up, and you have Sean Astin there, and Ki-Hoo Kwan.
Yeah.
And so that's just a really fun commentary between all of them. And Sean Astin has to get up in the middle to leave because he has to get back on a flight to go to Middle Earth, you know, that type of thing.
Sure. Okay, well, and so then my top five actual movies that are about a prison escape. Number five, I've done a whole podcast on it, so it kind of had to be on the list somewhere. Con Air is a prison break film where you're not rooting for the prison break. You want your there's like one so a couple of prisons in there you're rooting for, but you don't want them to escape. You want them because they get them out.
Right.
Anyway, it's Con Air, wonderful film. Doing 40 episodes on it was too many. Well, it's because, Rob, I love prison break movies. You know this, definitely. There are many, 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 many that I adore. Yes. And number four is a parody of one that is higher up on this list. It is Chicken Run. Love me some Chicken Run. Perfect film. And it is a parody, of course, of number three, The Great Escape.
Oh, that is so low. You're thinking,
Rob, The Great Escape is one. Number three? Number three?
So low. Oh, my God.
It's in my top four on Letterboxd, and yeah, it is. But it's number three, and I number three today. Tomorrow it could be number one. I don't know. It's been a little while. I think the last time I saw it was for your podcast.
Wow, that's been 5 years.
Like 20. No,
it's 5 years. 5 years.
So it's been 20. It's been 20 years. And I love The Great Escape. It's just hard to justify putting it on regularly, I think. Whereas number two, Toy Story 3. Not hard just by putting it on regularly. I'll put that on any day of the week. Love Toy Story 3. It's a prison. The daycare's a prison. It counts. And my number one is a film about a unsuccessful prison escape. The entire film, you've got these three characters who are stuck in prison just trying to get out. And their means of orchestrating the escape is by like bringing the facility down around them and taking out the guards of the facility and the scientists of the facility. And over the course of this, two of them are killed before they manage to get out, and then one of them manages to get out, but then immediately is killed. It's Deep Blue Sea is my number one prison break film. It is a prison. Aquatica is a prison for the sharks. The sharks are the victims. They just want to get out. They just want that Deep Blue Sea. And that's how we talk about it a lot on the podcast, is it's a prison break film. Shawshank comes up a lot as we talk about Deep Blue Sea. We've recently the scene where the shark gets out and then blows up immediately, and I related it to what if in Shawshank, I feel so sorry for the shark in that sequence, because what if in Shawshank Andy gets out, he digs through the he goes through the tunnel, the five football fields, and he comes out, he's standing in the rain, says, oh, I'm out, and then he just explodes. Just for no, he has no idea why he just blows up. How much would that suck? And that's stuck at the end of Deep Blue Sea.
Right.
It's made it out. It's been through so much and so many people. It just blows.
Okay. All right. I can understand that.
So yeah, Deep Blue Sea, number one.
All right. So now we will play the first of two daily games. This one is Name That Book Adaptation. So let's hope that this time it's actually something that has an adaptation, because I did check since yesterday. And you were correct that the Infernal Affairs was not a book. So, you know, you know, where I get a little fuzzy,
I will still take
where I get point. A little fuzzy on, you know, using AI to make a list, they put that on the list. But okay, I take full credit for not checking my sources, but whatever, it's still there. Let's hope there aren't any others.
This is why I don't use AI. This is why I don't understand people saying it's quicker to use AI, because you use it, you get the result, and then you still have to go and check it.
Yeah.
I completely
agree with you on that, but you know, when you're making a list of either 143 movies for this one, or for the next one where I needed to make a list of 401 movies, I would prefer that someone else makes the list, and then I can quickly go through it and hope for the best. You know,
I'm sure
the
sure
world is not dependent on whether this is sure correct or not. Okay. Yeah. So let's spin the wheel and hope you get a real novel. Okay. The name of the original book is called Cactus Flower from 2011.
Oh, I've heard of that. The book is from 2011 or the film is from 2011? Okay, when's the book from?
I don't know.
It's not going to help me.
I can check.
Cactus Flower. It's fine. Cactus.
It's a movie that stars Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston.
Murder Mystery?
Nope. It's 2011.
Just Go With It.
That's right. Very good. Yes.
That's a book? Jesus, okay. I haven't seen the film. Yes.
It's based on a play and based on the original movie Cactus Flower. There you go.
So, yeah. Fair enough.
Okay, so now we will play the other daily game of High-Low. And you see, these are a little more accurate.
Sure. Say hello to High-Low.
There you go. That ultimate instant frame, right? all right. So let's spin the wheel and see what we get. And around and around and around the wheel. Okay, the 2003 movie Master and Commander.
Oh, I'm looking at a DVD of that. Right in front of me. good. I haven't seen that for a while. I'll be watching it soon. IMDb, Martian Commander, let's go with 8.4.
7.5.
Okay. Rotten Tomatoes, 84.
85. Very good. Very good. Very close.
Okay.
Nicely done. All right, let's spin the wheel again. Okay, the 1984 film *The Killing Field*.
Ooh,
with Sam Waterston.
Time. Yeah, not a fun film.
Not a fun time, but an amazing movie.
Sure, yes, but not one I look forward to revisiting anytime soon. Let's go with 7.9. I don't know why.
7.8. Very good.
Okay, and then. 92.
93. Okay, very nice.
Okay. I'm finally locking into this game. One film left to go.
Actually, you have one more left until the finale. So in 6 months from now, you know, you get whatever's left. Ooh, okay. The 1972 film The Godfather.
Okay. Probably quite high. So if
just a reminder, Shawshank is 9.3.
Okay, so Godfather, right. I'm gonna say 9.2.
And you would be correct. Okay. Very good.
And then Rotten Tomatoes. It's 97? 98?
Jay, that's amazing. Very good.
Okay.
You got that one.
Good.
Excellent.
I feel like that was a bit of a gimme, that one. It's always going to be up there. Sure.
Well, again, it's completely random, so, you know, nothing you can do about that one. Oh. All right. So, Jay, for one final time this week, would you like to tell everyone where they can find Jay Clewitt?
Sure. So I mentioned Con Air earlier. We did Con Air, the podcast. We went through Con Air scene by scene, 40 episodes on that. It was a fun time. Rob joined us for one of those. And then Deep Blue Sea, the podcast, is the one that's still going, where we got to the end of Con Air and thought, we just want to talk about Deep Blue Sea again. And so we did. So we went back and talked about Deep Blue Sea again because we liked it so much. And at the time of recording, at the time of release, Deep Blue Sea 2 coming out. So we're restarting our coverage on Deep Blue Sea 2 again, going through that episode by episode. If you haven't seen Deep Blue Sea 2, it was a Deep Blue Sea 2. It's not as good as Deep Blue Sea, but it is a lot of fun to talk about. We have had a great time talking about that first time around, and we're looking forward to talking about it again and introducing some of our victims to Deep Blue Sea 2. A fun film. And Deep Blue Sea 3 is also very good. Oh, my dog has arrived to say hello and tell me it's time to stop podcasting. That's nice.
Well, your dog is right. Yeah, so why not?
My dog has just arrived. Right, he's licking my foot at the moment.
There you go. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movieroundminute@movieround.net. So I will be back on Monday. So everyone have a great weekend. But until then, get busy living.
Get busy dying.